Blue.
Oops. Excellent. Wow! Lovely question. I thought you were enlightened by now. Okay, let's get started. Devachan, how do we do contemplation? Is it when we sit down to meditate, what subject we usually contemplate out? Contemplate silence. And disappointment. The question. Now, what you do, you have to be still enough to do contemplation. Remember what I said the other day? Holding up something. What is this? I've dealt with this one before. What's this I'm holding up? Yeah, but what you do to contemplate, get rid of all of the names until you can see it. And see, you know, what it can be like. You know. And once you actually see it, you can actually use it for it really interesting. Oh, that's really good. So, we say stick, gong or something, you only have one idea what it is. But contemplation is taking something, staying with it long enough and getting some strange ideas, weird ideas, but actually very useful ideas, new ideas. Seeing things in a different way that you haven't seen before. It's what we call, you know, that's why we have these riddles. Just to see things in a different way you've never seen before. So, hopefully you haven't heard this one too many times. What's the only product that Australia produces that no other country in the world produces? No. Seen that over in Australians. That's the only thing Australia produces that no other country in the whole world is. And that's obvious, okay, that's an old joke. But you see, this is actually seeing things in a different way. That's why contemplation, you need to take an object like the self. Who's watching this? Who's listening to this? Hold it up in front of you and seeing not what you've already been taught, not all your beliefs, but holding up there. And then you see other ways of looking at it. It's called contemplation. But of course, the way you do it, you've got to be very still, first of all, and also sometimes courageous to see things you don't want to see. Good evening, Ajahn Brahm. Do I break the precept or I get rid of spider webs in my room and toilet? Wow! I'll give you 50 strokes of the teddy bear for that. I saw the top ceiling corner spider in its web, and a big spider in its web behind the toilet seat. Okay, sometimes if you can just catch the spider just without sort of killing it, because maybe I was going to tell this story just usually the last day when we struggled to get donations for the keeping this place going. But it's a story of the suicidal spider. You may not know that story, but here it comes. There was once this spider, just freshly born, just finished being taught all the basics of spider lore from its mum, and so decided to branch out on its own and found a nice little room and made a really beautiful spider web, you know, in the corner of somebody's room. And it was just a beautiful spider web, put so much care and effort into building the web. And it was just amazing feat of architecture and also engineering. And in fact, it looked so amazing. If there was the equivalent of Homes and Gardens for spiders, it would have been on the front cover. It would have been on the BBC. Of, you know, the amazing homes, because it was such a well thought out and very immaculate spider's web, and it took a lot of time. And after the spider was finished, you know, spinning its web, how the little spider sat in the middle of the web, exhausted, but really proud of its achievement, its beautiful web, waiting for lunch to arrive. And before lunch would arrive, the person who owned the house looked spider in my room and got a brush and smashed that web to bits. And the spider had to run for her life. And she ran as fast managed to escape the broom. So I went in the house next door and just got another little corner of a room, no one was around, and built another web. Of course, nothing is as best as the first one, because, you know, you have all the energy for that. But, you know, she was tired, just wanted to get a house, a nice little web, so she could relax, rest, and get something to eat. And again, there was a maid came into the house, saw the web, smash, crash, and again the spider had to run for her life. The third house, the fourth house, sixth house, seventh house, eighth house. Every house, the web got destroyed. And after eight houses, that poor spider, you know, even just thinking about a corner of somebody's house made it anxious, made it shiver. It had post-traumatic stress disorder, as you'd expect someone would. Imagine you built a house and it was always destroyed and you had to escape for your life. Not only that, it was so hungry and so tired because of sleep deficit and sort of hunger. It was also not really in its right mind. It got very tired, very sleepy, and also started thinking negative thoughts. Because when you're stressed, remember that the string is so tight, anything just makes it really, really, really resonate. So tired, it started thinking these thoughts. No one loves spiders. I've got no friends. No one accepts me. Human beings, they always hate me. And all I do is just take up a tiny corner in someone's house. And, you know, they got the rest of the room to themselves, and it's at the top, they never go up there. And I actually do a service for all the people in the house. I catch all these flies and mosquitoes, the sorts of things which people don't want in their room. And I do it for them, for free. And all I want is a bit of peace and quiet and someone to leave me alone and respect me and love me. But what's the point? No one loves spiders. And the poor spider started thinking these thoughts. Now this is what happens when you think negative thoughts like that. They got worse and worse and worse until the spider started thinking, what's the point? There's no hope for me. I'm going to be hungry. I'm going to be alone. I'm going to be unloved. What's the point of this miserable life? And started having suicidal thoughts. He became the suicidal spider. And so how could I kill myself, said the spider. So he was walking on the footpath. And he saw these people come past with their sandals and shoes. And deliberately tried to get underneath the shoes to get squashed. But always, every time, managed to get between that space between the heel and the sole, you know, which is raised, right, and get squashed. So I thought, right, I'm just going to go across the road. There's always cars coming up and down there, so went across the road trying to sort of deliberately place itself under the wheels of a car. But every time, it always got between the wheels, you know, not actually underneath them. Because that's what happens when you get really depressed, when you're in a bad mood, you can't do anything right, not even suicide. So the poor spider was suicidal depressed. I was just crawling along the footpath, just like someone who was drunk, not really knowing where she was going, just depressed, fed up, suicidal, and nothing was working out for her. But have you ever had that experience when you feel that someone's watching you? And that was what happened with this suicidal spider. She was there, and then she thought, someone's watching me. And she turned around, and she saw the fattest spider she'd ever seen, sunning itself in the afternoon warm sunshine. It was a huge spider. And the fat spider, like most fat beings, was very kind. And said to the suicidal spider, what happened to you? And then the suicidal spider started telling the sad, depressing, agonizing story of its short life. And you know, sometimes the people say, oh, you really wanted someone to listen to you. And so the suicidal spider was telling everything. And every now and again, The fat, happy spider, the jolly one, got out a tissue so he could wipe the eyes of the poor, sad, suicidal spider. It was so sad. All he wanted to do was have a bit of peace and quiet. He didn't want to harm anybody. Just a nice little corner of somebody's room, and he can't want to go to a room anymore. So hungry and so lonely. No one loves him. And when it finished, the suicidal spider stopped and said, "Hang on. How come you're happy? How come you're fat? Didn't that happen to you? Didn't you, when you made a web in somebody's house, didn't they destroy your web?" And the suicidal, the fat spider, "No, not at all. I've only ever made one web, one spider web in my whole life. It's still there. And no one ever disturbs me where I live. And I catch so much food." "In fact," said the fat, jolly spider, "look, out of compassion, you can come and live with me as well. There's plenty for two or three or five or six spiders where I live. I mean, I can come and live with you and be safe and be fed and have a good friend." "Yes, come," said the fat, happy spider. "Hang on a moment," said the suicidal spider. "Where on earth, in this part of the world, can you make a spider web where no one ever disturbs you?" "Oh, that's so obvious," said the fat, happy spider. "I made my web in the donation box of Jhana Grove Retreat Center, just over there in the dining room. No one ever disturbs me in there." So that's a suicidal spider story, which you can tell in any church or group or something you belong to and you want to raise some money. Unfortunately, it doesn't work. But it's a nice story, a suicidal spider. So anyway, the poor spiders. Now, okay, that if they are, you know, they've got some spiders which can sting you, but they don't kill you. So you can take them out if you want to, just very carefully, and just take them outside. And they'll be fine. Anyway, but no, it's just your precepts. But if you get rid of the spider webs in my room and toilet, some don't kill them. After this morning's talk on the hindrances, I realised how much guilt I carry from my past interfering with happiness. Any advice on moving forward? I tried the toilet paper ceremony and 50 strokes of the dog. Is the dog here? Anyway, I have the cat or the mouse or the spider. 50 strokes of the spider is very good. No, just the whatever's nice and safe. And then realize how much guilt I carry from my past. It is just understanding that, number one, you've been programmed to feel guilty. Because, you know, sometimes, you know, people say your mum said you did something wrong. Well, I feel terrible about that. And actually they don't punish you as much. But if you say, "Oh, you know, I just let it go," you callous person, and they give you more punishments until you feel guilty. That's actually, you see that many times in law in the Western world. If you feel remorse, "I feel terrible about what I did," then actually they lessen your punishment, lessen your sentence. That's why Buddhists really cop it when it gets to the legal system. They say, well, you know, you murdered somebody. "Oh, I let it go a long time ago." "No, we're not going to let you go." So anyway, the guilt never works. Because in the guilt, number one, you bury what you did. It comes up every now and again, destroys your life. And number two is that you can't move forward. So guilt is what usually hides the truth and stops learning happening. So what we learn how to acknowledge the guilt. Number one, it's worth letting go. You become a much better person. Not if you're more remorseful, you become a better person. No, you become a better person if you let go of that guilt. And number two, it should be done. The ethical benefits of letting go of guilt. And then, you know, it should be done. No one else gains anything about you being guilty. Just makes them angry. And next thing, once you realize it should be done, then it can be done. And this is actually where sometimes I break with psychology, but you know, sometimes when I've talked with psychologists, some of my good friends are known a long time, talk, and you know that, so they, you've got a point here. Just let it go. What do you mean I don't have to deal with it? No. Let it go. What you mean? You mean I don't have to sort of make amends? No. Let it go. Because that guilt, remorse, the pain of the past, is sometimes like you're travelling through life, dragging this huge heavy burden behind you. Like a sled or like a trailer, and you're just dragging it along, and it's just so heavy and so sticky up the mountains of life. And it's just so hard actually to pull. You can't make much progress, you can't do anything. You don't have to deal with it. You're allowed to let it go. To untie the bond between you and your past and just let it go. And be free. And of course you have all these incredible stories like this fellow Angulimala killed, some people say 999 people, but it's more like it was 99 people. Serial killer. And that's when he was number 100 on the list, was supposed to be the Buddha. But you know, the Buddha just can't be assassinated that easy. So what the Buddha did was there was he some sort of psychic power that this Angulimala couldn't catch up with him. So Angulimala shouted at the Buddha, "Stop, stop!" That's a really silly thing to say, "Stop so I can kill you." And then the Buddha turned around and said, "I have stopped, you stop." It was similar to that little novice's story. When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When am I going to stop? The whole idea of stopping. And all these things, instead of running away from the past, you stop. And then the past vanishes. So that's one way of getting rid of guilt. And after a while, do you think I was a really, really good boy? Do you think I was like a model son to my mother? I will tell you what I did on one of her on my mum's birthday. I must have been, I don't know exactly the age, maybe 8 or 9 or 7, somewhere around that age. And it was my mother's birthday. So what can I get for my mother's birthday? And so it happened in London, West London, where I grew up. There was a food craze, a fad, which only lasted about a year, of eels and mash potato, jellied eels and mashed potato. So I went to the shop without my mother knowing, the morning of her birthday, and bought one eel, a live one. So I brought the eel, took it back, and I already had everything else ready, a little shoebox in which I put the eel, and wrapping paper, you know, that's beautiful gift paper. And I just really, just, you know, 6 or 7 year old is not that skilled, but I really put a lot of effort into wrapping it up beautifully with a little tape and a nice little ribbon going around it. Tried a bow and a nice little greeting card, which I wrote in 6 or 7 year old kids' language, "To Mummy, with love from your son, XXX. And then I, you know, I could have been an actor because, you know, I pulled it off. My mum never suspected anything. Except I went up to her, surprised her, said, "Mummy, happy birthday." And, oh, you know, her heart was just almost exploding in pride that, you know, her little son had actually made a birthday present all by himself for Mummy. "Oh, thank you, darling." And they gave me a big hug and a kiss. And I was looking there just as if it was something which, you know, she didn't know what was inside there. And she opened it up carefully. And when she opened the lid, just, I could not have trained that eel to do it better because it raised up and looked at my mum. "Ah!" She screamed so loud. And I ran as fast as a 7 or 8 year old could. And I hid. I hid for 2 or 3 hours until the heat went down. That was what a great kid I was. Really cheeky and naughty. But anyway, just I don't feel good about that, and my mum just laughs at it. Kid being a kid. Anyway, so don't feel guilty about it. You learn from the past. Whatever you did, this is not a very nice thing to do to my mum. Should have actually checked her cardiac health before I did that. Anyway, you have mentioned about how even great teachers, when they get old, are not able to give inspiring talks and teachings. This makes me concerned as you two are getting old. What do you mean, getting old? So anyway, yeah, it is true. Because, there's a very famous teacher, Reynald Thich Nhat Hanh, and I just, he's a very inspiring teacher, but I went at this conference over in Hanoi some years ago, and he was there, I was sitting right next to him. And he gave a talk, and, it was the same thing, like an old boxer, really great when they were young, but just, boxes too much. The old footballer who was amazing when they were in their prime, but just goes a bit too far, too long. And just was the same. To get that inspiration, to be able to get that energy, and also innovation. Every now and again, I do tell a new joke, believe it or not. But that innovation, that inspiration, there's a time when, you can't do that anymore. So if that ever happens, I told my monks, look, instead of just, wheeling me out to give a talk, and just people thinking, oh, it used to be so inspiring. But, it's nice to actually to retire when the time comes to retire. We have heard that in jhana, the physical body is totally safe. How to build up trust that the physical body will be fine when awareness of the breath vanishes. All the great stories, such as the one which is in the suttas about, what sutra is it? I'll find it out for you. It doesn't come to my mind right now. Maybe it's time for me to retire. Okay, but this was the monk meditating in the forest. And two villagers came past, and they saw this monk perfectly still. They looked at him, he wasn't even breathing. Touched him, didn't move. So, oh my goodness, the venerable monk has passed away, he's dead. And what should we do? You see a monk sitting there in the forest, and you're Buddhist, and he's just dead. What should we do next? So they thought for a little while, we'll do the funeral. Because he's in the forest, there's lots of wood around, so it didn't take them too long to get a big pile of wood together in the funeral pile and put the monk on the top. And they did some little chanting, whatever they knew, probably not the right chanting, but something to do. So, and then they lit the fire, and once the fire had taken hold, the flames were coming up. They were busy people, they can't hang around all day, so the flames will do the rest of the job. So they went off to collect the mushrooms or whatever they were doing in the forest after they cremated the monk. And the next day, they were so impressed when that monk, the same monk, came on arms round in their village. Not even his robes were charred or burnt. Because that's what happens when you get into these jhanas. So, if ever that happens to you, don't need to be afraid. Yes, if people don't understand that you're just in meditation, you're not dead. Yeah, they may take you to the crematorium. They may put you in the oven. But when you're in the oven, and the oven attendant opens the door again, hi, me again. Not even your robes or your t-shirt will be burnt. Do you want to prove it? Maybe not. But anyway, but that's what happens. Can't be destroyed. And of course, that monk I was saying, I told you that story about Sudama, didn't I? Just being underwater for quite a few days. That's what happens. So if ever there's a bushfire in Western Australia, and if there's no way out, you're stuck, and the flames are coming towards you, what should you do? Get into jhanas. The flames will go past, and you'll be still sitting there afterwards. That'd be really cool. Be really impressive. I think you'll win $1 million from, was that Randy or something? Randall or that, whatever. Anyway, do crystals help with meditation? Not really. But, no, not really, I suppose, crystals. I suppose a cup of tea in a crystal glass might help me, but not really. So sometimes people believe in those energies, but if it works, you know, sometimes it could be the power of belief, but really we're trying to let go of total connection to the outside world. So I've never meditated with crystals. Dear Ajahn Brahm, my mind was very restless when I was driving one day. Is this a joke? No. Okay, no. Oh, what a shame. My mind was very restless when I was driving one day, so I decided to put my attention on the sound of cars driving past. I think my mind was so focused on the sound, all my other senses, including sight, disappeared. Uh-oh. It was really nice, but I remember that I was driving, so I had to force myself out of it. Is this a good method for developing a death wish? Oh, sorry, for developing deep meditation where one is not driving? Oh, come on, when you're driving, you give it everything you've got. Do the driving. It's not the time for meditating. And especially if you're driving me. So whoever that is, I'm not going to let you drive me. Now, you've got to put attention on the main object, which is like the safety. And this actually happened a few times. We used to do this meditation retreat in North Perth. And you know, after the retreat, and actually a couple of people did have accidents afterwards. You know, this was in the middle of town in North Perth. And they were driving and they just couldn't react quick enough. You know, they saw the car coming towards them, bang. Bang, bang, it was just Annie Show. They saw the red light, and just this red light, this too will pass, but not quick enough. So because of that, I used to tell people, okay, after a retreat, you know, if you're driving home, you know, two or three times around the car park, you know, just to get yourself used to the vehicle again and just, you know, get a bit sort of aware. Otherwise, you're just too slow, you're too really, really slow down. And that's a problem. On the loving kindness metta sutta, what does unbusy with duties mean? Means don't do too many duties or don't rush while doing duties or something else. Yeah, it means having few duties. Apakicca. But you know, I'm a bit of a hypocrite like that because I've got too many duties. But it doesn't mean the original one was called unburdened with duties. What that really meant was the people who translated that, the monks over in England at the time, they all had too many duties. So how can we do a translation which doesn't make us hypocrites? So, yeah, we have many duties, but it's not a burden. We're happy to do it. But that was called spin. So the real thing is just try and have as few duties as possible, if you possibly can. So otherwise, you know, sometimes if you have so many duties, like that bhikkhuni, no, just all she had the duty just to patch her robe. Ended up having, remember, what did he have? A cat to keep the mouse away, and a cow to feed the cat some milk, the field to get the grass for the cow, a boy to look after the cow, and a house for the boy to live in. And it just became, what for? You know, just to sort of patch a robe. So sometimes, yeah, that's modern life sometimes. You know, we serve all this so-called comfort, but it just makes life so much complication. So anyway, so unbusy with duties means just being able to unwind sometimes and just not have many duties, or sometimes just say no. So, you know, sometimes, you know, if you want to speak to me, say no, please, you know, not now. Because I have to say no sometimes. I told the monks that, you know, I have to learn how to say no, so... They tell me, is it okay if I don't go into town today? I say, no. Is it okay if I don't have a cup of tea? They ask me, I said, no. Is it all right? They ask me if I don't come to the morning chanting this morning. I say, no. In other words, the double negatives, which means, you know, they get whatever they want. Could you please clarify whether you need to experience jhana for insight to arise during meditation? No, there's many insights which you get, you know, in life, in meditation. But the real big ones are dependent upon jhanas. Not in a jhana, but conditioned by a jhana. When the jhana finishes, that is when you get the you get the deep insights. People say, well, you can't get deep meditation in a jhana. And it's just the same, you can't eat your curry when it's still in the oven. So why do you put it in the oven to begin with? Because the oven makes it hot and cooks it, so you can eat it afterwards. So the jhana is like cooking the mind. I say, what's the jhana means? It means I should warm it up, jayati, to burn it, to cook it, to roast it. So anyway, so it cooks the mind in a nice way. It makes it still, and you come out with beautiful insight. So, seeing things as they truly are, really seeing things, the jhana is the way. Often hear that attachment creates suffering, but some people are motivated to live due to their attachment. What is healthy attachments? Healthy attachments are attachments to looking after the nuns, being attached to making sure they all are well fed and put on some weight because they embarrass me. Just out of compassion for me, come on. Don't think about yourself. Now, attachment, it depends what type of attachment. Already mentioned, like, attachment to your precepts. This fellow, this Australian, some years ago, he decided to, you know, be a Buddhist and keep the five precepts at work. So, Christmas time, Christmas party, and they came up to him, he told me this, they say, hey, have some beer, have some wine or something, some alcohol, forget what they were serving. He said, no, I'm a Buddhist now. And they said, oh, you're a Buddhist? Yeah, that's amazing, wonderful religion. It's all about letting go. Come on, let go and have a drink. Don't be so attached to your precepts. So it didn't work. So he tried something else. So the next time he had some party, maybe Easter or something, or then they brought the drinks round and said, do you want a drink? Said, no, can't take a drink. Said, why not? You're still a Buddhist? No, it's not. No, it's just the doctor's orders. I said, oh, really, really? Okay. I'll get you something else. Because you know that for religious reasons, oh, no, you know, that people won't do anything there. But, you know, for when it's for doctor's orders, medical reasons, oh, yeah, that's really important. We don't want to kill our friend. So they got him something else to drink, non-alcoholic. He said, it worked. And that's what you should tell everybody, that if you go to a party, don't tell them for religious reasons, you know, I can't drink alcohol. Tell them doctor's orders. And I've never questioned you on that. But I questioned him. I said, look, I know you. You're perfectly healthy. Nothing wrong with you. That's lying. It's keeping one precept by breaking another. It's not doctor's orders. And that's when he scolded me. He said, Ajahn Brahm, I expected better from you. He said, didn't the Buddha often call himself a doctor? Oh, yeah, that's right. Dr. Buddha's orders. That's what it is. So that seems like Dr. Buddha's orders. Attachment. So sometimes we have to know what to be attached to and what to let go of. We're attached to precepts because they protect us. We're attached to kindness. We're attached to peace. We're attached to our teddy bear. We're always attached when we go on the back of a motorbike through the heavy traffic, always be attached. Don't let go yet. So the things to be attached to, and also it's just nature. But the real thing about attachment, the deep thing, is sometimes that when I was a young monk, obviously just gave up girlfriends and sex, and then you started getting really into food. Now you got really sort of love food and said, let go of that. And then it was, you know, sometimes like sweet drinks. And let go of that. And sometimes it's something else. And I noticed that, you know, whenever I let go of one thing, I started to attach to another thing, like, you know, compensating for it. And sometimes it was just so difficult. As soon as I let go of one thing, I picked up another thing. Don't be attached. And I got attached to something else. And there was a problem. And that's where I thought of, because, you know, I was aware of what I was doing. Look at my hands, always picking up something. You know, if you're not sort of, you know, picking up something, using it for something, and put it down, stop it, put it down. Then another moment you're fiddling with something else. How can you stop that? Because I realise that's what a hand does. A hand picks up things, it grasps. That's the nature of a hand. It's its purpose. It picks things up. So I said, how can I make sure my hand never picks things up? There's only one way. Cut it off. If I cut off my hand, I'll never be able to pick up anything anymore. And I thought, that's the secret of attachment. Try to focus on that end of attachment, letting go out there. But what about what's picking up these things, or why it's picking up these things? This thing in heart side. And that was the will, my self-image, who I thought I was. That was what was doing all the attaching. So it's a waste of time thinking, okay, let go. Yeah, I can let go. And then you're being attached to spiritual materialism. I can let go more than you can. Na, 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 na. My teacher's more enlightened than yours is. Na, 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 na. My that is like spiritual materialism, one-upmanship. So instead of that, we realize attachment out there is endless, letting go of one thing and then you pick up something else. But what's doing the attaching? What's on this end of the attaching? And that's where you find your sense of self. That's why it's quite difficult to let go, because when you really detach, you're letting go of who you think you are. And that can be scary. But it's worth it. Dear Ajahn, my cousin loves his mother and takes care of the family very well, but he kicked his father out of the house and refused to take care of him. His father has a second family outside the marriage and hurt the family. After many years, my cousin forgave him but refused to see his father. Although I encouraged him, I am worried he will get bad karma for treating his father badly. Will he go to hell for not being a filial child to his father? He can't go to hell because he's such a nice child to his mother. Sometimes just because we got two bad bricks in the wall doesn't mean it gets destroyed. You've got to look at the big picture, you know, the full story, the whole person. And he thinks he's doing it right, but, you know, it's not the best. But you can understand, because his father had a mistress, that the son just really didn't like his father for doing that, hurt his mother and caused problems. So you can understand why he kicked him out, but then refused to see his father. But you know what sometimes happens? Forgiveness. You know, at least, you know, he's getting less vindictive towards his father. Usually what happens after the years, okay, come on, you're my father. I don't agree with what you've done, but, you know, you can just say, well, okay, you're still my father, so I forgive you. That's the very best, that forgiveness in the very, very end. So anyway, but that will come, but just, no, he won't go to hell. He's not perfect, but, you know, he's not bad. What does a meditator renounce in meditation? Well, just going back to that attachment, there was, I don't know if you remember, there was this person called Rajneesh, and he famously said, I am so detached, I'm not even attached to detachment. Which is a very, very, very sneaky spin way of just confusing people and giving them authority to do whatever they want, which is not really correct. So what does a meditator renounce in meditation? You renounce your sense of self and your will. Because everything else which you own all comes from that. Where there is an owner, there will you always find your own something. So, it's a waste of time. Not a waste of time, it's good getting rid of possessions. But it's even more important getting rid of the possessor. But how can I get rid of the possessor? That's like eating my own head. Think about it. How can you eat your own head? Can't do it. So, what does a meditator renounce in meditation? If you want to renounce the possessor, you have to start renouncing doing stuff. Renouncing the future and the past. Letting it go. It doesn't exist, really. Renouncing being concerned what other people think of you. just renouncing all aspirations. Start with aspirations. You start with an aspiration, and then you get to the next stage, which is called desperation, and then you get expiration. The three aspirations of life. Oh, I didn't mention inspiration. The fourth. So you start with inspiration. Oh, this sounds really good, jhanas. And then you get aspiration. I'm going to do it. And then you get desperation. The last day, you still haven't got it. And then you get expiration. You give up. It's best to get there, first of all. So what does a meditator renounce? That's what they read. They also renounce judging. So many things you can let go of. Judging. Judging just really sucks. I just judge judging, haven't I? Total hypocrite. So, are you a good person or a bad person? Which one is it? Are you a good meditator or a bad meditator? If you say, oh, I'm a bad meditator, but if you interviewed all the other people who were here, you wouldn't feel that bad. Maybe I'm not so bad after all. There was worse than you. But anyway, we don't say good or bad. Just a person just keeps on going, and we don't judge. Ajahn, what is the experience of gentleness in meditation? What is the experience of kindness in meditation? Oh, wow, all these days I've been teaching you and you still don't know what gentleness is. Gentleness is just looking after your body, not being forceful. It means that if, you know, you've got an ache in the knee, you just look at the knee and just, knee, do you want to move? And if it is, just move it, because you're gentle with the body. Just like you're gentle with a car, you don't rev it up and do burnouts like they have in the front of this monastery. I haven't seen these scallywags who do that. It's probably not their own car, it's probably their parents' car or something. But, you know, they just wreck the tyres and put all this stuff on the road. So that's not being gentle. So be nice and gentle. A good example of gentleness is a teddy bear. Sometimes you squeeze it so hard it never complains. And kindness. Kindness, opening the door of your heart to this moment. With no conditions. With no expectations. That's the beautiful kindness. It's caring. It's opening. Have you ever noticed that type of love, you're totally accepted. The door of your house, your heart is totally open. No conditions. That is called letting be. Your father, whoever that was, or that person, yeah, he just really hurt your mum by having a mistress and having another family. Yeah, it's not the nice thing to do, but, you know, people make those mistakes. They're selfish, or they just, you know, what happens mostly, they feel they're in control. Guys, they think they can get away with this. But you always remind them of that. General Petraeus, who at the time he was the head of the CIA. And the head, the boss, with all that secret equipment and that training in undercover operations, you know, at his disposal. And still, when he had a mistress, his wife found out. So if the head of the CIA can't keep infidelity secret from his wife, you've got no chance. So because of that, just, you'll get busted, so just not worth doing it. So kindness, which means, you know, the person made a mistake, but you're kind to yourself, you're kind to others. Just like we're kind to that snake. Many of you now have seen the snake. Is a snake really upset? No, it's really chilled out. Simply because people are kind to it, doesn't feel fear. Many great masters still experience illnesses and disease like cancer and stroke. If they experience enlightenment and generate great karma, wouldn't that burn up such diseases of the body? And why is that just so gender specific, great masters? What about enlightened women? What do we call those? Great mistresses. Well, that's the master, mistress. Isn't that what you do? It means something else, doesn't it, mistress? That's why, you know, the head nun at Dhammasara, you know, that's Ayahasapanya. You know, We also call them an abbot as well. Because someone says, why don't we call them abbess? You know why? Because it's so close to abyss. There was, even ayah is a bit sort of, can be changed around a bit, because there was one nun, and you know, she was quite forceful, and when people didn't like her, they used to call her Ayatollah. You know the Ayatollah in the Iranian Revolution? Especially, what was the first one? Ayatollah Khomeini, and this lady was called Kama. Ayatollah Kama was her nickname. So not very nice, but that's actually why we make sure that, you know, we use a nice name, which is not possible you can sort of make a problem out of it. So anyway, many great masters still experience illness and disease, but even the Buddha got sick. He ate that pork curry at the very end, which caused him sickness of the tummy, and he died. So, some years ago, when we were doing these, a little bit of Q&A, what was a Q&A? It was like a quiz night. In Dhammaloka, a city centre for New Year's Eve. And you know, I asked these questions, see how much people knew of the Buddha's teachings. And so the question was, what was the Buddha's last words before he passed away? What was the Buddha's last words? And there was like, you know, points for good answers, but also points for funny answers as well. And the one which I will never forget, that someone said, the real last words of the Buddha was, don't touch that curry. I thought that was really so cool. Anyway, because it's the human body dies. Human body gets sick, but the mind is always peaceful. Most good people get reborn in heaven. From a Buddhist perspective, what are the heavenly dangers? Is there such heavenly realms like the Pure Land, where there is no suffering and one can practice meditation and learn the Dhamma from the Buddha and Bodhisattvas residing there? Yeah, there is such a thing as the Pure Land. You know what it's called? Jhana Grove Meditation Retreat Center. It's a heavenly place. You must agree it's a heavenly place. The food is delicious. There is no suffering, only mental suffering. You've got beautiful, your own en suites, you know, nice beds and nice cushions and bed. And you learn the Dhamma from the great masters and mistresses residing there. So you've made it already. This is the Pure Land. It doesn't get better than this. So, just come and get enlightened. But anyway, heaven, I was going to say something about heavenly beings. So, some nice stories. Instead of ghost stories, just really heavenly stories. And this, if you haven't heard this before, this is one of the most inspiring of heavenly stories. And authenticated many times over. The person who was involved in this, I haven't seen him for many years now, but I knew him. He was an American working in the Peace Corps in Thailand. And after a couple of years working in the Peace Corps, you know, he had, you know, still some free time before he was going to go and whatever he was going to do next. So he'd always seen, you know, monks. He wanted to, you know, finish off his cultural experience by ordaining as a monk for a short time. You know, to, you know, find out what it's really like, because, you know, in Thailand you can do that, temporary ordinations. But he didn't know how to become a monk. So he was staying in a hotel, you know, on the edge of Bangkok. So he asked the concierge what to do. And the concierge in such hotels know many things, know many places Americans can go. But, you know, this was a monastery, and so the concierge was not really all that experienced sending people to the monasteries. And so he half knew where to go, but it wasn't accurate advice. He said there's a monastery in the center of Bangkok called Wat Bawon, and there are sometimes Western monks ordained there and live there. And so he said, that's the sort of place for you. But yeah, I know where I can get there, but what do I do? He said, well, the nice thing to do is to get some alms food. So get some alms food and go there early in the morning when the monks come out on alms round. And then, you know, choose one of the elderly monks, it must be senior, put some food in the elderly monk's bowl, and then just ask, you know, please help me, I want to become a monk. And so that's what he did. It's not the best advice, but that's what he did. But when he said early in the morning, he didn't know what early in the morning meant. He got there about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And the whole place was locked up. And there was no one around. And he was walking up, you know, this monastery with a big wall and gates all padlocked, not locked, but locked up. And he's walking around wondering what to do. He had his little food offering ready, walking up and down, and then, you know, sooner or later a Thai man came up to him and asked him, said, now, what are you doing? And he said, well, you know, you want to become a monk, and this is what he was told what to do. And so the Thai man said, oh, you know, that's not really the best advice, but it doesn't matter, because I can actually look after you until the monks come out on alms round in another, you know, a couple of hours' time. Because I've got the keys, I can get you inside. So he opened up this gate and took the keys out, opened up the gate, it was a metal gate, and he walked down the path into the main ordination hall. Now Wat Pho Wan is a royal temple, that's where the kings of Thailand, you know, get ordained. Even for a short period of time, that is their temple. So they walked in there and he turned on the electric lights, opened up the door of the main temple. And many of you, if you've been to those traditional Thai temples, now they've got the murals on the inside of the hall. They're all just painted. And those murals are very difficult to decipher because it's like a cartoon. But no, Western cartoons, you go from one cartoon, the next one, but these go all over the place. If you know the story, you can actually tell just how the characters and the story evolves, you know, through following the drawing, the mural. And it's mostly like the stories from the Dhammapada or the Jataka tales. And so it takes a lot of expertise. And this Thai fellow was just amazing, just his knowledge of those paintings. Not just what the story meant and, you know, what the meaning of the story was and its moral message, but also just who painted it and why it was donated, because maybe some child had died earlier on because of typhoid, or other people just had a little bit of difficulty in whatever it was in their business, and they did this as a donation to try and make some good karma. It was just amazing, just the whole story. And at the end of this explanation, that time fly past, his guide, his Thai man, told him, he said, well, now this is come to the end now, and the monks will come out pretty soon, another 10 minutes. Just go out, I'll lock up and turn off all the lights. You just go out there, turn to the right, wait for this old elderly monk. He's the one to ask. So, you know, this man is, well, no, I shouldn't say his name, I was going to say his name a moment ago. So this American monk, he went out for the instructions, and sure enough, this monk came, put some food in the monk's bowl, and said, I want to become a monk. You know, in his broken tie, the best he could do. And the monk said, just wait here, I'm on arms round, I'll take you inside afterwards. And that's how he started, you know, his training to be a monk. Trouble was, there's many things you have to learn, and there's many sort of much chanting you also have to memorize. And the American was given sort of a mentor who was, you know, sometimes you just couldn't understand this guy's English. So, you know, one day, after 2 or 3 days and getting frustrated, you know, with the trainer, he just asked him, he said, well, you know, is there not another monk in this monastery who can speak English, who can help me with all the, you know, the routines and the ceremonial rites and rituals? And the monk said, well, you know, this is the best monk we've got. You know, this is the guy who speaks the best English. And at that point, the American said, well, what about the temple attendant I met the first day? He spoke absolutely perfect English. I understood every word of his. What temple attendant? Oh, the guy who let me through the door. And he said, no lay person has the keys to that gate. And I know that very well, because that's the royal gate. Walked past it so many times in my life as a monk in Bangkok. Still there, obviously. Only royalty are allowed through that gate. royalty, no one else. And no one can actually turn on the lights at that place where he described. And no lay people have got the key to that temple. That's the holiest of holies. And this was so weird, they took him immediately to the abbot, who later on became the head monk of Thailand, Somdet Nyana Sangwara. Saw him many times. And the abbot listened to the story and stopped him and said, "Secretary, come here." And they started writing it all down. It's still there, written down in the history of that monastery. Because, again, no layperson can actually go through that gate. It's a royal gate. And they haven't got the keys for that. And they can't turn on the electricity there. They haven't got the keys to the temple. That's with the monks. And not even the old abbot knew the stories of who painted those paintings and what they even meant. Could sort of work it out, but this was amazing. And now, at the end of that, they wrote it all down and they asked the American, "What did that man look like?" And the only thing he could say, he was wearing like old traditional Thai dress, not modern dress, it was old Thai, and it spoke perfect English. But what did he look like? Now, you know, if you, it's very hard to describe another person you've only met for a couple of hours, and so you say, well, he was Thai. Well, they all look the same. No, they don't all look the same, but, you know, what do you look like? Well, I don't know. And he was scratching his head, and as you do, he stopped as he was looking at a portrait hanging on the abbot's office. It was him. That's who it was. King Rama IV, main sponsor of that temple, died maybe 150 years beforehand. That is why he could walk through that, open that gate. It was a royal gate, it was a former king who had sponsored that temple. That's why he knew everything about those paintings, because he was there, you know, when they were painted. And this American didn't even know just, you know, who that person was on the wall there. And that was the old king of Thailand who was there, who sponsored and built that temple. I know that monk. Well, I lost contact with him some time ago. Obviously, knew the former Sangharaja. He died maybe about 4 or 5 years ago. And I also remember talking about that in Singapore. I told that story during a visit to the Thai ambassador, and this was in his embassy in Orchard Road. He said, no, I know that. I've read that. I've studied that as well. It's a true story. Someone who died a long time ago, a king, coming down as a heavenly being to help someone become a monk. Absolutely true. Interesting. Heavenly story. Real. Anyway, next question. Thank you for the Dhamma talk on the green monster. It's not green monster. It's the anger-eating monster in the Queen's Bay. It's green, okay. I only realized until yesterday there was also one residing inside me too. Ha 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 ha. It behaved exactly the same manner as your talk. I was struggling for the last 5 days trying to meditate without realizing it. The harder I tried to concentrate on my breath, the larger the monster grew, with all the gooey stuff expanding inside me like I was going to explode. Today, following your priceless Dhamma talks on meditation, we have now become good friends, the monster and me, giving me the nice pleasant energy when I behaved during meditation this afternoon, except towards the end when my mind unconsciously wandered away, the unpleasant sensation started to surface again, and that got me back on track to my breath and letting go of thoughts and awareness. Thank you. So I decided the anger-eating monster is an absolutely brilliant metaphor. Comes from the Buddha, I said, but I expanded it quite a bit. And it works in so many things. Get out of here, you don't belong. So be kind to the monsters. And then they relax and vanish. Okay, ho ho ho. Now this is interesting, simply because I've noticed this many times, maybe this time of the retreat, you know, when we have questions, there's a sort of synchronicity comes. Question, what does not busy with duty means in the suttas? It's amazing that, you know, how all these days to say that, and there's probably another one in there, people actually start, because they're meditating together, so one person's thought starts to resonate with somebody else's. You have the same thoughts, the same questions. I already answered that, but the interesting thing is just, you know, this the questions tend to sort of group together, same questions. Obviously different writing. Shouldn't one do your duties to family, society, etc.? How does it relate to right livelihood and eightfold path? It's not having too many duties. And actually, to be busy with duties, I think I wrote a little book once, and I said, well, real busyness is doing too many things at the same time. Because that's what sometimes happens. You know, you're answering the phone, and you're drinking a cup of coffee, and then you're thinking about the answer to the email. That's really being busy. Doing one thing at a time, amazing how much you get done without looking busy. Most people who are happy married are blessed. If a person fails to find a partner and gets married, is that means he or she probably has a lot of bad karma, that is his lifetime they have to be alone. That means I've got very bad karma. And the Buddha, actually Buddha got married, but he managed to escape. So it's a bad karma to be alone. How many of you have been married and finally, whew, that was a close one, now I'm free. There was a story that, no, it's not bad karma, it's what you make of being married or what you make of being alone. There was this two sisters, they came for some counselling. One had really bad marriage. So that, you know, she was, you know, should I try and fix it up or should I sort of, you know, give me some help? And then her younger sister was always trying to find a partner. And for some reason they'd have a relationship for maybe 1 month, 2 months at most, and it would fall apart. You know, she wondered, what's wrong with me? Why can't I find a partner in this world? So I said, well, you know, you're, you know, a woman who's suffering because you haven't got a partner, and your elder sister, she's got a partner she doesn't want. I've thought of a solution for you. Well, you know, your family, sisters, you share. You know, you take your elder sister's husband, so she's happy and you're happy you've got a husband now. They, for some reason, they didn't understand that. There's a mark, I thought it was so logical. But what we came to afterwards was a nice little insight into Dhamma. Said, your elder sister, you've got what we've called husband suffering. When you have a husband, it's very difficult sometimes. You've got husband suffering. But if you get rid of your husband, you will have what your sister has, single woman suffering. So what do you do next? And say, we become a nun. So when you're a nun, you don't have husband suffering, you don't have single woman suffering. What do you have? Nuns suffering. Because I remember that. When I was a young monk, really working hard, I looked at Ajahn Chah and just look at him sitting around all day. Just, he doesn't have to work hard. And he gets the best food, the first in the line. And what does he get the best food for? He's got no defilements, he's enlightened. I really care about my food. You know, you should give it to me first of all. The non-enlightened ones get first choice of the food on the buffet. Whatever's left, now those who are enlightened, he doesn't really care. So I had what was called young monk suffering. Now I'm an old monk, senior monk. And now I look at those young monks. They don't have to talk to people all day and just, you know, just answer all these questions and just sit up there and just take responsibility. They don't have to do all this stuff which I have to do. They don't have to sit up there after the meal and get people come and take photographs of you and just I want to go to the toilet. They won't let me go to the toilet because they have another photograph. And just 5 minutes and speaking all this stupid water all over the place and just stuff like that. So now I realize I've got elderly monks suffering. So that's a problem, isn't it? It's just, we always think that if we can get rid of this, then we won't have any suffering. But you just change one form of suffering for another form of suffering, that's all. So you live, say, in India, and you have Indian suffering. Then you come and live in Australia. You don't have Indian suffering anymore. You have Australian suffering. Changing one for the other, that's what happens. Oh boy, there we go. So that's, if you're happily married, you're blessed. And what was it Socrates said? You know, if you find a happy marriage, then good on you. But if you're unhappy in marriage, you become a philosopher. So that shows you what Socrates' marriage was like. My peaceometer is always, okay, marriage jokes, some marriage jokes. Yeah, marriage jokes. Marriage is like a pack of playing cards. You start off with two hearts, and then you move on to a diamond. And later on, you get out the clubs and finish with a spade. But not all marriages are like that. There's some really nice ones and good ones. So, like a marriage, it's what you put into it. It's really important. My peaceometer is always maxed out on the peaceful side. No, you can always go more peaceful. Great for stillness, but I can't seem to get my emotions back when I need them for metta or to find joy in the beautiful breath. Help! It means your peaceometer can go even more peaceful, because the more peaceful, the more still it is, the more content you are, then the metta really starts to flow. Teddy bears, kittens and puppies don't do the trick for me. Well, if they don't do the tricks, what does actually create a feeling of loving kindness for you? And joy. It could be like a little flower, a little piece of grass, the birds, or just a snake. Just, you know, going there and just doing what it needs to do. Oh, sometimes you have a lot of love for snakes. Because no one else loves them. They're rejected. So you care for them. So when you get the emotions, and of course there is you, open the door of your heart to yourself. So when you're really still, give it a bit more time for stillness, and the energy comes. And it's, you love everything in the whole world. Can you please tell us about Dharmasara? Are you the abbot? No, I'm not the abbess or the abyss of Dharmasara. Or do they have a different leader? Yeah, they lead themselves. Are the precepts the same for the monks and nuns? Sort of. A few here, a few there. What would be a schedule for an average day for both a monk at Bodhinyana and a nun at Dharmasara? Oh, you get up in the morning, you have breakfast, have a nap, get up for lunch, have another nap. Got someone shaking their head, yeah. That's what you should do. That's what the idea, that's what the fantasy is. So what you do, you just go there and find out. For the first time today, I felt restless. Didn't happen in the previous days. Is it better to get distracted doing stuff or walking or to sit with it during meditation? The classic advice is, if you're restless, thank you, restlessness, for coming to visit me. Don't try and get rid of it. Just treat it like a nice monster, anger-eating monster. And just say, restless, and thank you, come, yeah. You know, just like when I was fighting restlessness and made the deal, 3 to 4 p.m., sexy thought time, anything goes, and then when I let it be, it stopped being restless. Find out why you're restless. Why? Instead of trying to stop it. Is it important to maintain a straight, upright posture while meditating? Yeah, look at me. No. Okay, this is a nice little time for this piece of Dharma. Sometimes you start with a nice, straight posture, and you get very, very peaceful, and then the posture changes by itself. Because this was a time, classic story. This was again in the North Perth when we used to hire this place to do meditation retreats before we built this place. And this fellow came, oh, this was a woman, sorry. She was meditating and her body started twisting around, really, really heavily contorted.
And one of the other people, they sort of tapped me on the shoulder and said, look at that woman. Because they were concerned about her. When I saw just the position of her body, I mean, that was just, you know, twisted so bad. That's going to really hurt. It's going to break things. I can't even demonstrate it to you what she was doing. If I did, you'd have to take me to hospital. It was really extreme. And at that, I just had to wait for her to come out of her meditation. Please come over here. And so I said, you know, how do you feel? Are you okay? I said, I feel wonderful. I feel so relaxed. And then that surprised me, but then, okay, I get it. And I said, where did you have your car accident? I never told you that. How do you know? I just, you know, just adding two and two to get four. I said, because you were so contorted during your meditation. Because I know that if you let go of the body, just let it do its thing, it will move. It will go to a place where it can do its healing. And she, you know, she told me about her car accident. You know, just the car was totaled. And, you know, she was lucky to come out alive. And her body was just so damaged by the accident. You know, she'd recovered a lot, but there was still a lot of healing to do. And that's why she, the body was twisting around so it could get the energy going the way it needed to. The only way the body could actually get that energy, that healing energy, chi if you wish to call it that, getting into the right place was twisting around. No way she could do it by herself. She had to totally be peaceful, let the body go, and that's what the body did. And it was, you know, sometimes you wish in hindsight you could have taken a photograph of that and just to show that just, and she, you know, she started off sitting straight and it just did it by itself. So from that time on, you just, you know, let the body, body's much wiser than you, I don't control it. So it sits straight, but then after a while, just the body will find its best posture. How is it possible that such a controlling being such as Amar is able to abide in the heavenly realms? Good question. And the reason is because it is the power, sorry, it's the happiness of power, the pleasure of controlling others. You ask Donald Trump, why on earth would a person like that want to become president of the United States? He's got enough, it's not for the money, he's got enough money. It's the power, it's the pleasure of controlling others. That's all. So that's why Mara is the control freak in chief. So, you know, it's just like Donald Trump multiplied millions of times. And of course, you know, when people get out of Mara's power, that really makes Mara fed up. So this is actually where sort of Mara is both a being who lives in those worlds, who gets off on controlling them and exerting mastery over others. And that's why the symbol of Mara, your will controlling your body, your mind, that is the problem. Is it true that when someone first makes the decision to ordain that Mara can create obstacles? Sometimes they can, but not really. You know, quite frankly, that, you know, there's only one Mara, there's millions of people, so they're not really going to, you're not that important, frankly. So because of that, Mara just, you know, won't put obstacles in you. And anyway, just that story that, you know, sometimes heavenly beings, you know, can actually just help you. Could you please tell the story of Lumpur Jamdian, who was invited by NASA to go to the United States? So he's a really interesting monk. This monk is still alive. And is really weird stuff. So, he happened to be in Houston visiting a Thai temple there when NASA, the headquarters in Houston, they were installing this huge mainframe computer. Now, the big number cruncher. Tens of millions of dollars worth of equipment. State of the art. It's NASA. And so they installed it all. Hundreds of engineers, top of their profession. When they installed it all, they couldn't boot it up. They couldn't get it to work. And so they didn't know what the problem was. They got the best experts all over the United States to try and fix it up. Every hour it wasn't working. It was costing millions of dollars. They're really getting desperate. So, one of the engineers was a Thai Buddhist. He said, well, you know, if we can't, this is actually what he said, if we can't fix it up, perhaps it's something supernatural. And they all come off it. But he said, look, if it is, we have the monk here in Houston, just happens to be here. Just invite him in. It doesn't cost anything. So monks are just such good value for money. Just give them a cup of tea and they do anything. So, nothing to lose, he was there. So they invited him in, gave him the security clearance, and he went into the mainframe computer room, and he did some chanting, he meditated. Metta, loving-kindness meditation. That was his big thing. As soon as he came out of meditation, that computer worked perfectly. It was true. And this is, it happened. He fixed the mainframe computer just by meditating. And, of course, I was so happy with him. But, you know, how can you say thank you to a monk? So what they did, of course, NASA having lots of high-level contacts, they managed to get him a special visa. At a time of Homeland Security, a very simple forest monk has in his passport a diplomatic visa to come and go into the United States any time, no expiry for the rest of his life. Now you think that maybe, you know, just, you know, out of kindness, or maybe it's out of, you know, if you've got sort of a skeptical mind about of their own best interests. So if the thing goes wrong again, they can invite him, they don't have to get a visa for him, get straight away. But he did that. And I know that because when he came over to the United States and he came into San Francisco, it was Ajahn Pasamo who told me this, he met him at the airport. And, you know, checked his visa, was in order. He said, what on earth are you doing with a diplomatic visa with no expiry date? And that was the story. Checked it out, it was true. But the other thing which happened when this monk came to San Francisco airport was that, you know, you've seen these little bags which we sometimes have. You see me sometimes take it when I go to Bodhinyana Monastery. They're called yams. And Ajahn Pasamo was messing around with one of the zips, you know, in his yam. It was stuck. And Ajahn jumped in, so I said, oh, I'll fix that. And so he opened up his robe, and from his pocket he got out a pair of pliers to fix up. And said, Ajahn said, you didn't take that in the cabin, did you? Oh, yeah, I'll take it wherever I've got. And he opened up his robe. He had a whole tool, this tool set in there. Three or four screwdrivers, knives, pliers, wrenches, hammers. Now, it's really eccentric because, you know, he says this is some karma from his past. He has to carry this around. Really heavy. I mean, not light stuff. Lots of metal. And he said, I mean, you go through all those x-ray machines? Oh, yeah. Don't you ever get caught? No, I just threw my metta and the machine just doesn't beep at all. That is unbelievable, but that's true. He does that. So, fortunately, you have to have really good psychic powers, and also you have to, those psychic powers, if you misuse them, you lose them. So that means it's perfectly safe, you know, you won't sort of use that to cause terrorist activity up in the air, because it's too good for that. So it just, all that means is just everything just never beeps. And you wouldn't believe what he carries around with him. Ooh. And the thing never goes off. So much for security. Anyway, amazing people do these sorts of stuff. What are moods? How should moods be handled? Oh, this too will pass. Yeah, you get depressed. Sometimes the depression or the tiredness or the elation. It can be just, you know, just time of the year. It can be food, diseases, sicknesses. You know, did I tell you already that I was diagnosed with a contagious disease? I think I did when I first came here, didn't I? I should have warned you. It's called Hepatitis. Hepatitis B. Not Hepatitis, Hepatitis. and it's very contagious. Be careful. So how should moods be handled? Oh, just, you know, let them come, let them go. Are some moods caused by moodiness? Yes, such as a woman expecting a baby, feeling cranky and emotional, of course. You know, sometimes people say that you men don't know what it's like having a baby. And I pat my tummy and said, yes, I do. The weight which I carry around every day, and that's one of the reasons I do this, you know, to experience, you know, what pregnant women feel. So I know what you feel like. Any excuse. When I was nearby the dam sitting quietly, two rabbits emerged from the bush. One rabbit was a wild rabbit with a cotton tail, and the other rabbit was a pure black colour rabbit, very similar to the wild rabbit with the size ears, etc., but except the colour, white and black. They were hanging around there a couple of minutes and slowly went into the bush. I was thinking, could it be a domestic rabbit? But domestic rabbits are quite large and a bit different, except a dwarf rabbit like my pet rabbit. Later, a thought came to my mind, reminded me of your black owl story. So it was just my perception, or was it just a domestic rabbit? I don't know, but it was very beautiful to see and made me happy. That's good enough. So it doesn't matter what colour the rabbits are. So just very nice seeing a couple of rabbits. And again, because, you know, you're kind, those rabbits can come up. Can you tell the story of the bad snake? I'll tell one story already, so I should tick that for another day. Did you hear about the monk who went to a hot dog stand and asked the vendor to make him one with everything? One with everything. Now, anyway, I prefer... Oh, no, it's a little bit naughty, but, you know, it's a really good joke. This was from the Vietnamese comic in Australia. Was it Do? It is very funny. Because, you know, he said that, well, you know, because it came from a poor place, you know, during the Vietnam War over in sort of Vietnam, and, you know, people said, oh, those Vietnamese, they eat dog meat. And he said, well, you have nothing else to eat. You have to eat whatever we can get. So he said, as soon as he came to Australia and he saw the sign, hot dogs, he said, wow, Vietnamese food. But when he went there, he was so disgusted. He said, even in Vietnam, we don't eat that part of a dog. So funny, that guy. And really, to make the Australians... You see, he was at the school one day and he came home and asked his daddy, Dad, what does IQ mean? You know what IQ means? I'm an Australian citizen now, so, you know, it's like, what does IQ mean? He said, well, you know, IQ is a measure of intelligence. You know, most people have about 100, that means average. If you've got an IQ of 120, you know, you're really smart. 130, 140, you know, you go to university, you know, you get a good degree. If you've only got sort of, you know, 80, you know, you may be just an ordinary person, you know, just get a job as a mechanic, or I don't know. But, and if you've got an IQ of 60, you know, you're so stupid, you probably won't be able to tie up your own shoelaces. Oh, is that why most Australians wear thongs? Oh, that was quite funny. But the nice Australian story I remember, the Vietnamese story I remember, was this Vietnamese refugee who came in a boat. And the first people they saw, you know, just, you hear those stories of the boat people from Vietnam War, what they went through. But he managed to, you know, see the mainland of Australia, and just, you know, really hungry and just, you know, amazed they'd made it. And he said the first people he saw was these two Australian fishermen who saw, you know, emaciated sort of refugee sort of coming close to the shore, and shouted out to them, welcome to Australia, mate, have a beer. And he always remembered that welcoming. And he's now the governor of South Australia. He told that little story, just how he started off with, you know, just nothing. But he always remembered the welcome he got as soon as first two people he met. Have a beer, mate. Not really a Buddhist welcome, but, you know, it was just the kindness and the welcoming and the accepting. And from that, you know, he was such a good fellow, did so much. He became the governor of the state of South Australia. Anyway, question. I have two friends take their own lives after battling anxiety and depression. What happens to someone after they take their own life? What does it do to their karma? Because they took their life to ease their suffering. Oh, they come back and have another go. Just because you fail a test first time, doesn't mean you can't retake your driving test, or you can't take your, what's it called, the English as a second language test. You know, what's when you become IELTS. Yeah, because there was this Malaysian girl who came to see me in Olamara, and she'd taken that test 16 times, you know, the English to get a visa test. And she said to me, she said, you know, I need this test. I've got to pass it. Otherwise, I can't get my visa. You know, what am I supposed to do? So take it again. But I failed 16 times. But how many times have you taken it with Ajahn Brahm's blessing beforehand? Will that help? Nothing to lose. So I gave her a blessing, really full on. And she called me afterwards, and she said, I passed. And she sent me this nice little card, thank you, Ajahn Brahm. I scolded her, I said, you should have done it the first test and not wasted all that money. So, if you make a mistake once, you can have another try. So why is it that we think a person who's taken their own lives, you know, they've got so depressed, they've done that, so feeling so hopeless, they don't get another chance? Of course they get another chance. And sometimes next time they do a better job. They're always allowed to make mistakes. Should they go to hell, be punished forever for taking their own life? Should they? Why do we judge people just on how their life ended instead of how their life was lived? So when you judge it how it's lived, not rather than how it's ended, then there wouldn't be too much. They had a good life, so they go to a heaven realm. They learn their next time to forgive themselves and don't sort of end their life again. Your friend, the ex-monk who died in a car crash, oh, did he not have enough merit when he was a monk to avoid such actions and live out his years till old age? His karma is so complicated. It's scary to think good people meet such fate. Please explain. Thanks, Ajahn, very much. Oh, there's some karma, and some good karma, some bad karma. We always have a bit of each. But I remember, you know, him that's obviously very, very well. And when he, I remember him because I was, you know, probably his best friend. So when his parents came from America, you know, I went with him in Bangkok. And he said, you know, they're staying in a hotel. It was actually an old American serviceman's hotel because his father was a colonel. And they said, what can we get for you two guys? You know, calling me a guy. And they said, well, you know, what can we get? And so this is in a hotel room. And I said, well, you know, one thing we've never had for the last about 6 or 7 years was like a hot bath in the tub. That's what we did as an indulgence for parents. Is that all? So anyway, he was a good friend. But when he had a daughter, he called his daughter Metta, loving kindness. And that what happened, that they were, he got married, and he was going to Yosemite National Park, and as he was coming back from Yosemite, a head-on collision. And he was killed instantly. And his wife, cradled the young kid, went right through the windscreen. She was killed on the impact on the tarmac. But the baby was totally unharmed. Survived everything. And later on, a woman, when I was in San Francisco, I think it was in Pasadena, she came up to me and said, are you Ajahn Brahm? I said, yeah. Actually, she had a picture. He said, well, that's my dad. You know, my name's Metta. Who's this other guy next to him? That's me. So, you know, I shared some stories, you know, of him, you know, when we were young monks. And no, she's done fine. So sometimes that happens, but people have another chance, they come back again. What is their view about life? I already told you about life. Life is a sexually transmitted terminal disease. How did it all start? Why do we want to start? Oh, crikey, that has to be the last question. I'll do the other ones tomorrow. It's 9:30. Why do things have to start? Even retreats. Yeah, it finishes. Does it really finish in a couple of days' time? No, there's always another retreat next week somewhere. Instead of having straight lines, things go round in circles. Because this is some science for you. Many years ago, 300, 400 years ago maybe, people thought this world was flat. And Chinese culture, you thought you were the middle of the world. It was the Middle Kingdom. And in Europe, the Mediterranean, which means the middle land. We always think we're the center of things. And people felt the earth was flat and the earth was the center of the universe. And the stars and the sun went around planet Earth. That's how egocentric we were. But later on, people realized the earth isn't flat. It hasn't got a beginning or an end. It hasn't got any edges. If you travel in a boat, you don't fall off the edge. People were really scared of that. They thought they'd come to the edge of the earth, and that would be the ending. They'd fall off the edge. But then they realized this planet Earth is not flat. It's a sphere, which has limited area, but no beginnings or ends. You can go to the west, the east, south, east, anywhere here, and eventually you'll come back straight to Jhana Grove. Jhana Grove is the center of the earth. But you know that's only relatively speaking. But that is something which now everybody understands. This is no beginning or an end to this earth. It's just round, it's a sphere, but limited in size. So then, you go to the universe. And I remember as a young student studying physics, wondering, what is this universe? Does it have a beginning and an end, an edge to this universe? And I used to sometimes fantasize or try to conceive what the edge of the universe would look like. Would it be a brick wall or razor wire? Or just an abyss of blackness. Nothing made sense to me, because if there's an edge, this is a wall, there's something on the other side of the wall. Even an abyss, you know, if you fall in an abyss, you know, you're on the other side. There must be, you know, it just makes some sense. And then, of course, when you go and study science at university, you realize there is no end to this universe. There is no edge. This universe is, curved. It has a limited space. It's not endless volume. It's only, you could actually work out, not that hard, the volume of this universe. It's not infinite. It's volume. What is it? Too much now. But it's not infinite. But it's got no edges. How could that be? Because it's curved, just like the surface of the planet Earth. Limited area with no edges because of the curvature of space. That's a universe. It has no edges, no beginnings, no ends, and therefore no centers. But limited volume. That is standard knowledge accepted by all astrophysicists. Now, we go to the next level. Time. Why does time have to have a boundary? Why do we feel if we could travel back in time with a Doctor Who TARDIS time machine, if we go back far enough, do we get to the beginning of time? And if we go further, then we fall off the edge. Do we think if we go further into the future, we'll come to the end of time, Armageddon, after which time does not exist anymore? None of those ever made sense to me. But time being curved does. Imagine curved time. No beginning, no end, but limited in duration, just like planet Earth. Curved time. That's beautiful because that solves all the problems. And I mentioned that Professor Stephen Hawking, which I would have bumped into, you know, in Cambridge when I was there. He was there, but not in a wheelchair at that time. So I'd have sort of met him there somewhere. I would have been to the same lecture of Professor Sharma. Anyway, that even Stephen Hawking, he, in that biopic, the Theory of Everything, he said at the very end, and my ears pricked up when I checked with Professor Bernie, he now understands a universe without boundaries. Not just space, but time. No boundaries, no beginnings, no ends. People who thought the Earth was flat now get laughed at. Flat Earth people. Now, people who believe that time is flat will sometime in the future be called flat timers. People who believe in beginnings and ends. Instead, curved, samsara, round and round on the wheels of existence. Not just space, but time. But if you don't agree with that, sometimes there is edges, there's ends. Like the end of this session, which is well due, because it's going over time, and I need a rest. So, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And to prove my point, we'll see you again tomorrow. Time is round, and tomorrow will be, actually not the same chanting. Tomorrow we agreed, apparently somebody pressured me on this, to do the chanting in Pali tomorrow, the Metta Sutra in Pali. And something even more interesting tomorrow evening. Tomorrow evening, I will be giving the evening talk at in Dhammaloka Center in Nolamara. And I do that not just to give the talk there, but to mean that questions and answers tomorrow will be answered by the nuns, so that you can ask all these questions like, what's it like at Dhammasara? Is it really like what Ajahn Brahm said? You go to sleep, get up for breakfast and have a nap again afterwards. Is that what it's really like over there? Why are you a nun? So all these questions, because sometimes I like doing this, because they know it's always me giving the answers to the questions, but it's wonderful. But all these people who you've seen here sitting quietly and peacefully, now you can get to know them and ask questions. So the questions tomorrow night will be answered by the nuns. Isn't that exciting? Look for that, forward to that. You also have to do the chanting in the evening as well and ringing the gong and stuff. But that's tomorrow evening. Yes. Okay, so have a nice evening. See you tomorrow.